From WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall, and this is Choral Arts Classics. Tonight on Choral Arts Classics, we continue our 11th season with an exploration of what many people believe to be the single greatest piece of choral music ever composed, Johann Sebastian Bach's monumental setting of The Ordinary of the Catholic Mass, his Mass in B minor. This past Sunday afternoon, the Choral Arts Society performed the B minor Mass for the first time in nearly 10 years. Last month here on Choral Arts Classics, we had the first of two programs devoted to the Mass. Tonight, we welcome once again Ray Sprenkel, the composer and musicologist who's a great friend of this show and a well-known lecturer on all things musical. We'll talk some more about Bach and what makes this particular piece so unique and so powerful. Hello again, and thanks for joining us for Choral Arts Classics. I'm Tom Hall, the music director of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and the culture editor for Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast here on 88.1. WIPR. We're so glad you could be with us tonight. And as we have done for the past 11 years, on the last Tuesday night of the month from September through April, we get together and we listen to and talk about great choral and vocal music, and we sample recordings and live performances of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society and our special guests. I appreciate your tuning in and joining us tonight and every last Tuesday of the month on Choral Arts Classics. Tonight, we'll listen to a recording of the last time we had the great pleasure of performing this terrific music in 2004. Before we check in with Ray Sprenkel, let's begin by listening to the grand finale of the first large section of the Mass, what Bach calls the Misa. The Misa includes 11 separate movements of music, and it comprises the first two prayers of the Ordinary of the Catholic Mass, the Kyrie and the Gloria. We're going to listen to Cum Sancto Spiritu, or With the Holy Spirit, which is the concluding chorus of the Misa. This recording of a live performance features our full chorus and orchestra, music of J.S. Bach, here on Choral Arts Classics. Sancto Spiritu,
Gloria Dei,
on 88.1 WYPR. It's Choral Arts Classics. I'm Tom Hall, music by J.S. Bach, the final movement of his setting of the Gloria that was Cum Sancto Spiritu in Gloria Dei Patris. I conducted the Baltimore Choral Arts Society Full Chorus and Orchestra in a performance we gave in March of 2004. Our soloists in this performance were Jennifer Casey Cabot, Heather Buck, Marietta Simpson, Ryan Turner, and Thomas Megliaranza. It's my pleasure now to welcome back to the program Ray Sprenkel. He was with us last month when we started our little exploration of the B minor Mass, and we're delighted he's back. He's on the faculty of the Peabody Conservatory of Music, and he lectures about music for many organizations around town. And back in the day, he even hosted a music program here on WYPR's predecessor, WJHU Radio. Ray Sprenkel, always good to see you.
Nice to be here again, Tom. Nice to be here.
Really is. And nice to have such a great subject to talk about.
We should do 5 shows on this.
Yeah, we could. I mean,
I was just thinking about the Cum Sancto. It is said that Handel, Bach's great contemporary, was more of a vocal composer and Bach was more of an instrumental composer. And if you want to try to get that notion across to singers, just sing the Cum Sancto, because the parts are instrumental parts and he writes them for voices.
It's one thing to negotiate the notes with your fingers on a piano or a violin.
Or on a cello.
But it's a whole other thing to try to get your throat to do it.
That is really instrumental music for a choir. But that's one of the fascinating things about the B minor. I mean, he does stretch the human voice. I wonder if you can take it any further, frankly. You sing this piece, you're done.
Yeah.
Time to go out and drink, you know.
You know, there are people, you know, like Beethoven stretches the range of voices. You know, the sopranos and the tenors in the finale of the Ninth Symphony have to sing incredibly high for an incredibly long period of time. So the sort of physical demands of that are something. But the musical demands, getting this music in your ear, is both a great challenge and a great, incredibly gratifying thing. I mean, our rehearsals, you know, leading up to the performance we did the other day, just each week, you know, we would chip away at it and just get a little bit more of it sort of in our DNA. But it takes a while. It's a cumulative process. Whereas a piece like Handel's Messiah, you can really sort of negotiate the pitches fairly readily, fairly easily. Mm-hmm. Handel's music is easier to sing than Bach's. It's not to say it's better or worse, but just as in, you know, the 1960s, we had groups like the Beach Boys and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones doing completely different things.
That's right.
You know, in the 1740s, we have Handel in London, Bach in Leipzig, Germany, doing completely different things within the context of their musical cultures.
I don't know if you know the name Buchhofer or not, Tom, but he was famous at one time for writing a book called Music in the Baroque Era. And he argued that some of the complexity in choral Bach, vocal Bach, can be attributed to this business of instrumental Bach. Bach attempting to, said Buchhofer, transfer the idiom that we associate with instrumental music, in this case, to choral music. And to be specific, the Cum Sancto, Buchhofer would argue, I think, is really a toccata. And if you just, listeners might, to the program, might think just for a second, you know, the most famous toccata and fugue is probably the one we think about. Halloween coming up.
Right.
Imagine singing it. And that's what he asks people to do at times in the B minor Mass.
Yeah. We're going to listen to now, some music from the beginning of the next big section, the Nicene Creed. And again, Bach setting this Catholic liturgical text, Credo in unum Deum Patrem Omnipotentem, I believe in one God, Father Almighty. But the Nicene Creed was a Catholic thing, certainly not uttered in the Lutheran Church. I mean, here's Martin Luther, the one that, you know, broke away from the Catholic Church.
Yes.
So there were some pretty strong delineations between what was transferred over and what wasn't. Not to say that the Lutherans don't necessarily embrace, you know, most of the concepts in it, but certainly one holy and Catholic apostolic church is not part of the Lutheran theology that Bach understood in those days. So, again, we talked about this last month on the program. He's not writing this for the normal purposes. He wrote a cantata for every Sunday of the liturgical year 5 times over.
Yeah.
He was writing for specific, he wasn't writing for concerts, he was writing for specific liturgical events.
You know, one wonders if he saw that dying. I don't know the answer. In other words, that business of a very a cantata as part of the weekly Lutheran service and staged, performed by very high quality musicians. I wonder if that was in decay. And maybe that's what he wanted to do with it. All the music he wrote from his cantatas, he wanted to take some of it and do the Mass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because as we said last month, he uses some of that music he had performed and composed for these cantatas in the B minor Mass
right.
by simply putting the new words to it, the liturgical.
Now, the credo he does not these two movements.
Right.
To my knowledge.
These are brand new.
Yeah,
these
and they're new. Very late Bach. I think they are 1749 Bach.
Yeah, and
I believe.
And he died
the next year.
In 1750. Yeah, yeah. So this is the end of his life. And again, as we talked about last month, throughout this piece, Bach demonstrates his ability to write in all known musical styles. So we have two choruses here. The first beginning Credo in Unum Deum on a chant theme. You hear it in the tenors first, and then it's repeated in all of the other parts. And then that breaks into a very modern sounding chorus, Patrem Omnipotentem, Father Almighty. So he's got music that seems to be from the Renaissance period, based on what we call a cantus firmus, literally the strong song, and then music that could be right out of a modern opera in the 1740s. So let's give this a listen. Credo in Unum Deum and Patrem Omnipotentem.
Again, we can't prove what I'm about to say, but I know Albert Schweitzer, who was a great promoter of Bach, said that the first piece we're going to hear here represented all the Christians of the past. And then when it suddenly becomes up-to-date Baroque music, that's Bach's generation.
Music from the Nicene Creed from the B minor Mass of Sebastian Bach here on Choral Arts Classics. music of J.S. Bach and a live performance by the full chorus and orchestra of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. We heard the opening chorus of his setting of the Nicene Creed, Credo in Unum Deum and Patrem Omnipotentem. It's Choral Arts Classics on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall, joined in the studio again tonight by Ray Sprankle. Pretty good music there, isn't it?
There's another aspect of this art that we haven't touched on today, Tom, and in the last program, and that's numerology in Bach's music.
Symbolism associated with particular numbers, intervals, numbers of measures, that kind of stuff.
I do not pretend to know anything about the numerology of other of the Earth's great religions, but I do know that, for example, in Christian numerology, of number 3 represents the Trinity. Number 7, creation. These are anybody who knows something about that tradition follows follows what I just said effortlessly. The number 5, if you don't know, in Christian numerology represents the number of wounds that Christ suffered on the cross. And you cannot escape the fact that in the Crucifixus, Bach places that movement 5th.
Right.
Of the 9 movements of the Credo. And having said 9, that's 3 times 3, which is a perfection in itself. And I believe in the whole Mass there are 27 movements, which is 3 to the 3rd, perfection squared. And so it goes. It manifests itself in surprising ways, like the Et Incarnatus Est movement. Et Incarnatus Est. He does repeat one note there, but there are 5 different pitches. 5. Crucifixus, 5. And the Crucifixus movement, there's a bass line that's played over and over again. Musicians call it a ground or a passacaglia. And it consists of 5 descending half steps. Back to the Et Incarnatus Est movement, the string section plays da di da da da, da di da da da, all the way through the piece. And if you count the notes, there's the number 5 again.
Yeah.
And after a while, this is not an accident. We're not making this up,
right.
What I try to.
At some point, you think, oh, that's just coincidence.
Yeah, it's not.
But there's a plan here that is incredibly sophisticated.
And you wonder, again, who did he do this for? For himself? It was just a form of self-pleasure? Was there anybody else around? Maybe his sons? I don't know. Who appreciated the kind of games that are going on here? And are they games, did the actual creative act for Bach consist of, from the very beginning, understanding something in terms of Christian numerology? Was that one of the sources of inspiration? Food for thought.
Yeah, and of course, you know, we talked about this on the last program. He signed all of his pieces SDG, Soli Deo Gloria, solely for the glory of God. And he's also, of course, both in ways subtle and not so subtle, preaching to his choir. The Bach Passions, the St. John Passion, the St. Matthew Passion, have a definite agenda. He is trying to be persuasive and convincing about the story that is the central story of the Christian tradition and its importance and significance to individual Christians' lives. He was a music minister
at Leipzig.
His church in Leipzig, the Thomaskirche, the St. Thomas
Church. And
he
was expected to do this.
Yeah, so his vehicle was, or his medium, if you will, was music, but the preachers, their vehicle and their medium was the pulpit and what they said. What Bach performed was his way of preaching literally to his choir and to his congregation.
Yeah, people who listen to your program will know the name Jacques Barzan, who died in the last year, kind of a cultural historian of repute. And he argued that Bach wrote, he argued that there are 2 kinds of music. There's pictorial music and there's poetic music. And he said that Bach wrote pictorial music, that his music is a series of pictures.
Yeah.
And he does what he does in order to paint using notes as opposed to colors.
Literally, you know, illustrating what the text is talking about. Yeah. So, as you mentioned, there are 9 different movements in this Credo section. The Credo is the setting of the Nicene Creed. And, of course, composers have the wherewithal and the authority, if you will, to divide these texts any which way they feel like it. You know, there's no book that says you have to divide it into 9 parts. You can divide it into 40 parts if you want. You can divide it into 2 parts. And different composers divide it in different ways. But Sebastian Bach does divide it into 3 sections of 3 movements each. The first 3 movements, and we heard the first 2 of those, Credo in Unum Deum and Patrem Omnipotentem, we have a chorus in the old style, the stile antico, then we have a chorus in the new style. At the end of this Nicene Creed, movements number 8 and 9, we have a mirror of that. We have another chorus in the old style and another chorus in the modern style. Following the music we just heard, Patrem Omnipotentem, there is a duet for solo voices. In the third section, those last 3, we've got a solo aria that precedes the 2 choruses. So it's hard to imagine. If you imagine I'm standing in front of a blackboard and doing a whole, you know, Glenn Beck thing, but there's this mirror of the first 3 movements and the last 3 movements. So what we're going to listen to now is the middle 3 movements, which begins with this movement you were just alluding to, Et Incarnatus Est, and then the middle of those 3, Crucifixus Etiam pro nobis sub Pontio Pilato Passus et Sepultus Est. The Latin means was crucified under Pontius Pilate, died and was buried in a tomb. And this is, as you say, the 5th movement, again, that number 5 being so important, and it becomes the cross, if you will, the center fundament of these 9 movements. It's right in the middle. And then it is followed by the text that resurrexit tertia die secundum scripturas, and was resurrected on the 3rd day according to Scripture. And that music, of course, totally different than the music of the crucifixion, which is so incredibly sad. And there are musical devices here. For example, the use of the tritone, an interval
in the crucifixus. The devil.
Yeah. It's called the Diabolus in Musica.
And that bass line that Iria referred to, which is repeated over and over again on the crucifixus, 13 times.
Yes, 13. Yeah, 13, which is really quite extraordinary. So here they are, 3 choruses that form the middle of the Nicene Creed, Et Incarnatus Est, Crucifixus, and Et Resurrexit. Music of Bach featuring the full chorus and orchestra of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society here on Choral Arts Classics.
Thank you. vos, et mortuos vivos, et mortuos.
It's Choral Arts Classics, music by J.S. Bach, the centerpiece of the musical setting of the Nicene Creed, the section in which the text discusses Christ's incarnation by the Holy Spirit, his crucifixion, and the resurrection. Three wonderful choruses from the B minor Mass. I'm Tom Hall. I conducted the Choral Arts Full Chorus and Orchestra in this performance that we gave back in 2004. We're sampling some of that concert tonight as we talk about Bach with the composer and musicologist Ray Sprenkle. He joins me in the studio. So, Ray, we talk about this Mass. We identify it the way we identify many other Masses, and that's simply by the key that it's in. So, you know, Mozart, there's the Mass in C minor. You know, Beethoven has a Mass in C. We pick a key and say, okay, he's written a Mass. We call this the Mass in B minor, but very little of it is actually in that particular key.
I think there are five movements, five of the 27. It's one out of five or so.
So how did the term B minor get attached to this? The first movement's in B minor.
The first movement's in B minor, and the Benedictus movement is in B minor. There's some other movements in B minor, but the truth is, as Tom, I think there are 12 movements in D major. I read that somewhere, but there are clearly more movements in D major, so why not call it the Mass in D major? And this was pointed out to me by a student. I frankly had never thought this, and she says, well, how come? As far as I know, let me see, the first publication was in the 19th century, and it was called the High Mass in B minor. And this is speculation now, and the reason for calling it the High Mass was Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, to put Bach's Mass in this category of a very serious effort, blah, 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 and a very sober piece of music. And then the subsequent publications, they just cut out the expression high, and it's come down to us as the B minor Mass.
And loved, and certainly...
Well, I think choral societies live for pieces of music like this, and this is certainly one of the pieces that they live for.
Yeah. Sure. Now, Beethoven's writing his Missa Solemnis for a concert. I mean, there was no ifs, ands, or buts about that.
Right.
He knew it was going to be a big public
performance. Oh, yes, that is.
Well, Bach, as we've mentioned previously, is not writing this for a concert. He's writing this as a summation of all of the different styles, his kind of last will and testament.
Yes.
To sort of show that he can write in all of the styles of the day. So he didn't give public concerts the way that Handel did and Beethoven and Mozart and Haydn, but he did give many public performances because he played in church and conducted his chorus and orchestra in church every single Sunday.
Yeah.
But tell us about his life in the final job that he had. He held, what, five positions, I think, throughout his professional life. And Leipzig, Germany, is the last place that he lived in. And he worked there for 20-something years before he passed away in 1750.
Yeah, most of his life he was a church musician. There's Arnstadt and Mühlhausen, teen years. And then there's Weimar, where he was for 7 or 8 years, where he wrote principally organ music. He was an organist there. And there's Köthen, which was a court position for 6 or 7 years, and that's where so much of the instrumental music comes from.
The Brandenburg concertos, for example.
The solo pieces for violin, solo, cello, first volume, Well-Tempered. And then he goes to Leipzig, and that's where he is for the last 20-some years of his life, 27 years. My reading of Bach, Tom, is I think that he was primarily a church musician at Leipzig for 10 or 15 of those years. And I think some dissatisfaction set in. He becomes more and more engaged at the university. And there is this Abendmusiken, these evening concerts that he did there with basically university people and probably students, probably young people.
Yeah, and they did some secular music there. He even wrote a couple of really fun cantatas that are kind of like mini operas, the coffee cantata, stuff like that. Yeah.
And then you get to the last decade of his life, and you don't even, you take pieces like A Musical Offering and The Art of the Fugue and the Goldberg Variations, you don't even realize he's a church musician. It's as if that has faded away. And then you have, of course, the great B minor compendium. And I think the last manuscript of St. Matthew Passion, I think, also is dates from the 40s. I don't know. Is this a guy who's in his last years and he knows it? He's failing. It cost him labor to put the notes down. His manuscript is labored. Is he somebody's looking back on his life and he's saying, I've got to put these notes down. I've got to make a record. When I was a kid, we were taught that Bach didn't care about posterity, but I don't believe that for a second.
No, I don't. I think this piece proves it. I mean, he was losing his eyesight by the time he put this together. I mean, he was certainly failing physically.
Now, whether he wanted to leave good manuscripts for his sons, which is true, there's no doubt about that, or who went on to become musicians, more famous than her father, or whether he was... leaving it for posterity, I don't know.
He was also quite active as an organ tester.
Yes.
He was brought into churches all around Germany to see if the new organs they had built
were up to snuff. Yes. And if from what I know of him, if we could go back and see him in a time machine, I think a lot of the culture of that region of Germany perceived Bach that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. The name Bach, by the way, means brook, a little creek. But apparently in that part of Germany, it was so common for a Bach to be a musician that it came to be known as a bandsman. If you're a Bach,
Literally the meaning of the name.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. A bandsman. You're a puffin tutor. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's how he was perceived.
Well, he was a pretty good puffer and tutorer, let me tell you. Well, we're going to listen now to a little bit more music. This is some of the most ebullient, glorious music in the B minor Mass. We're going to listen to three choruses that are performed without pause, the Sanctus, the Plenis Uncelli, and Osana in Excelsis. So Sanctus, again, a piece that he wrote separately for a Christmas Eve service early in his career in Leipzig.
1720s?
Yeah. Some 30 years before he's writing the rest of this, and followed by Plenis Uncelli and Osana in Excelsis, Hosanna in the highest, the end of this prayer, Sanctus, Sanctus, Sanctus. Dance music. This is a gigue. This is music that gets your toes tapping and your arms flying. This is great stuff. All right. Well, Ray Sprinkle, before we hear this music of Bach, I just want to say thanks so much for stopping by.
My pleasure.
Always a great pleasure to see you, and we shall see you sometime soon.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Ray Sprinkle from the Peabody Conservatory, our guest this evening on Choral Arts Classics. Now more music of Bach, the Sanctus, Plenis Uncelli, and Osana in Excelsis from the Mass in B minor here on Choral Arts Classics.
Sanctus.
music by J.S. Bach, some dance music from the B minor Mass. We heard three joyful choruses, Sanctus, Plenis Uncelli, and Osana in Excelsis, performed by the full chorus and orchestra of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. On 88.1 WYPR, I'm Tom Hall, and this is Choral Arts Classics. Before we go, here's one more movement from this awe-inspiring piece. It's Bach's iconic setting of three simple words, Dona nobis pacem, grant us peace, a prayer that is as pertinent today as it was in the 18th century when Bach composed this incredible music. A prayer for peace from Sebastian Bach, our final offering tonight on Choral Arts Classics.
Thank you.
final movement of Bach's iconic masterpiece, the B minor Mass. This recording from a performance the Choral Arts Full Chorus and Orchestra gave at Goucher College's Krausauer Auditorium in March of 2004. We performed the B minor Mass again just a couple of days ago. We'll play excerpts from that performance on a future edition of Choral Arts Classics. Next month on the program, a conversation with the conductor Stanley Thurston, and music by the composer and singer and teacher and former member of Sweet Honey and the Rock, Esai Barnwell. We'll listen to her cantata, Fortune's Bones. To hear Baltimore Choral Arts live, our next performances will feature the women of the chorus singing The Planets with Maren Alsop and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. We'll be part of four performances starting a week from Thursday. And looking ahead, our annual Christmas with Choral Arts concert will be at the Cathedral of Mary Our Queen on Tuesday night, December 10th. You can hear that concert broadcast live here on WIPR. But if you'd like to join us in the audience, come to baltimorechoralarts.org for information about how to get tickets. Also, when you visit baltimorechoralarts.org, you can order Choral Arts CDs, including Christmas at America's First Cathedral and a recording with jazz legend Dave Brubeck. Again, for information about all of our concerts, please come to baltimorechoralarts.org or give us a call at 410-523-7070. You can hear Choral Arts Classics on the radio or on demand. Go to WIPR.org and catch up on shows that you may have missed or shows that you'd like to hear again. The producer of Choral Arts Classics is Aaron Henkin. Don't forget to tune in to The Signal Friday nights at 7 and again on Saturday afternoons at 3 o'clock. It's produced by Aaron Henkin and Lisa Morgan, along with Andy Bienstock. And please join me, Sheila Cast, and Nathan Sterner for Maryland Morning tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, right after Morning Edition. I'm Tom Hall for WIPR and the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next month on Choral Arts Classics.